Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 391 to 242 vote in the UK Parliament rejecting Prime Minister May's best and last attempt at a Brexit deal, and assess what might follow as the March 29 deadline to crash out of the EU fast approaches. James Cronin, a professor of history at Boston College and an associate of the Centre for European Studies at Harvard University and author of Global Rules, America, Britain and a Disordered World, joins us to discuss a country in the grip of zombie politics as the Frankenstein monster of Brexit continues to sow disarray and division. With the Prime Minister holding on to a slim Conservative majority in Parliament, which gives the far-right small Northern Ireland Unionist Party in her coalition undue influence to take a hardline position, and the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, proving again to be feckless and indecisive, the prospects for a way out of this mess are not at all clear. But if there is to be a do-over, the original narrow victory for the Leave campaign would be overcome by the demographic changes in Britain since the vote, where the older pro-Brexiteers have died off in sufficient number to give a majority to the younger anti-Brexit voters who are now old enough to vote. Then we'll speak with Carol Anderson, the Chair of African American Studies at Emory University and author of the new book, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. She is a columnist for The Guardian and joins us to discuss her article in The Guardian, American Democracy is in Crisis. A House bill could help heal it. And we will discuss H.R. 1, which has been dismissed by Republicans but has not been championed by Democrats, even though it is a roadmap to fix most of what is wrong with our politics and restore our democracy so that it works for all Americans. Then finally, we'll get an update on the deteriorating situation in Venezuela, with electrical blackouts now adding to the agony of a beleaguered people impoverished by hyperinflation who have run out of food and medicine and are defenseless against criminal gangs taking advantage of the chaos to loot and shoot with impunity. Javier Corrales, a professor of political science at Amherst College and author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution, joins us to discuss how Maduro blames the Yankees as his ruinous misrule continues while the Trump administration fans the flames of division as the country slowly dies. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is James Cronin, a professor of history at Boston College and associate of the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, and he serves on the board of 20th Century British History and on the board of Contemporary British History. He's the author of Industrial Conflict in Modern Britain, Labour and Society in Modern Britain, The Politics of State Expansion, New Labour's Past, What's Left of the Left, and his latest book is Global Rules, America, Britain and the Disordered World. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Cronin.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know about the disordered world, but certainly Britain is disordered. And, you know, you feel it's almost like Brexit is, it's sort of zombie politics. It's like this Frankenstein that just keeps wrecking the body politic and nobody seems to know what to do with it.
Yes, that seems to be the case. It has certainly brought out the worst in people, or at least in the system, in British politics currently practiced. Even today, after today's pretty decisive vote, it's by no means clear what's going to happen. So one could imagine ideas that we thought were dead rising zombie-like once again and parading around and even attracting some votes in Parliament. So, yes, it's a strange phenomenon.
And the vote that just took place today, 391 to 242, not as bad as the last vote rejecting Theresa May's Brexit deal, but this was her last shot. And now it looks as though they get to vote on whether they leave without a deal on March the 29th, and failing that, whether Brexit should be delayed. So is that as much as we know about these future uncharted waters?
Well, those are the formal agenda items that will, we think, dominate events tomorrow and Thursday. There are wrinkles all around. I mean, just before Parliament adjourned at 10 p.m. this evening, British time, Theresa May put in a resolution about the issue you referred to, about not leaving without a deal. But even then, that was controversial and confusing. She put that in and seemed to recommend voting against a no-deal proposition and a no-deal exit, but then added a phrase about how she also, or they also, or whoever votes on this, also recognizes that the default option is to leave legally on March 29th. I don't know what that phrase is doing there. Perhaps it doesn't signify much, but perhaps it could indicate some stratagem that we haven't quite understood yet. And of course, she seems to have indicated by doing that that she would support a motion against a no-deal Brexit, which of course infuriates the Brexiteers, the pro-Brexit forces within the Conservative Party. So it's, and they're maneuvering, in fact, not just both parties or three parties or four parties, but all sorts of private MPs are adding motions, amendments to existing motions to be debated tomorrow. So tomorrow could be quite exciting. It could be simple. We don't want to leave without a deal. Or it could be, there could be new wrenches thrown in, new terms thrown in. And then, of course, what that leads to next is also complicated, because saying you don't want to leave without a deal means then you clearly have to ask for an extension for the time to leave. But the European Union doesn't have to give it to you. So that's, so there, the next 2 days could be, you know, very surprising and very interesting.
Well, for all of the accusations against Theresa May that she's putting her party interests ahead of the country and being whipsawed by that small Northern Ireland party that she needs in this very shaky coalition she has, for all of that, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has never been a profile in courage. He never took a strong stand about Brexit in the initial vote, and had he done, this whole catastrophe may not have happened. And, you know, he seems like a total Hamlet type. He doesn't seem at all decisive. And now he's calling for a new general election.
Yes.
That's ridiculous. Yes. I mean, you can't, sure, have a general election at some point in the future, but don't you have a crisis on your hands here?
You would think so. Everybody says so. I think, though, that it's, it maybe makes more sense to think of Jeremy Corbyn as playing a game, that strategy that we might not agree with, but that he's not quite Hamlet. I mean, he did say 2 weeks ago he would support a second referendum, and that was taking a position that people had wanted him to take, and he finally did it, and it looked like he had resolved to move in a certain direction. But he's been pretty consistent, and what's consistent about Corbyn is that he is someone who himself is not really opposed to Brexit and probably supports it in his heart of hearts. But he leads a party, most of whose members and supporters are strongly opposed to Brexit. So he's, you could argue that he's being devious in that he's got one position and leading people to think he would actually delay Brexit or get a different Brexit or not even support Brexit. But I think he's somewhat consistent in that he has never been a consistent opponent of Brexit. And so far, he's done very little to actually stop it.
And again, I'm speaking with James Cronin, Professor of History at Boston College and Associate of the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, and he serves on the board of 20th Century British History and on the board of Contemporary British History. He is the author of New Labour's Past, What's Left of the Left, and his latest book is Global Rules, America, Britain, and a Disordered World. Well, one of the great ironies of all of this, James Cronin, this endless Brexit wrangling and the lack of clarity about where they're heading, they're certainly heading off a cliff on the 29th, if they can't come up with some kind of plan, and the only person who seems to be focused and certainly is profiting from the whole thing is Vladimir Putin. I mean, there's pretty substantial evidence of that the biggest funder of the Leave campaign, the original Brexit campaign, Arron Banks, is a conduit for Russian money. And from that point of view, just looking at geopolitics, looking at the fact that we got a president who's ambivalent at best about NATO and seems to be have some kind of peculiar relationship with Putin that may well involve some kind of compromise, that's a scary prospect. But the one person who seems to be very good at diminishing NATO's power, at undermining the EU, and splitting Britain off from the EU in a state of total political chaos is the guy in the Kremlin. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Yes, I agree with that. He and his people must take a certain delight in watching this endless series of defeats for the British government and dead ends and failures. I mean, I think there's pretty good evidence that the Russians were supportive of Brexit and that there's certainly some funny money that made its way to the Brexit camp through this guy, Arron Banks, as you say. On the other hand, I mean, local characters in Britain did a lot to bring this about as well. And sure. I wouldn't want to, you know, not criticize them. I mean,
Nigel Farage is probably
the most responsible for this outcome, or this impasse, really, is David Cameron, who called the referendum in an absolutely foolish and highly arrogant mood, thinking he would win it easily. Total misjudgment. And as I say, you know, incredibly arrogant. And he'll go down along with
all of
Jeremy Corbyn as architects of this mess.
Well, I was going to say, you go down in history like all of those arrogant British generals that brought us Gallipoli and the Somme and the et cetera. You know, that sort of, you know, upper class incompetence. But so, you know, we hesitate to leave our audience in total despair.
Yes.
Is there any sense that you think that there'll be a wake up call here? I mean, I've always thought that a do-over makes the most sense. It's not clear if you had another referendum what the choices would be. The choices in the original one were pretty straightforward, remain or leave. So is there a formula that could work?
Well, I think so, yes. The clearest formula is, as you suggest, a second referendum. There is debate about what the choices would be. The logic, I think, at the moment, the plan that would have the most support is a choice between May's deal and no Brexit at all, that is, remain. Obviously, the Brexiteers, the fanatical pro-Brexit people, would be upset about that, but they are clearly a pretty small minority. And by most people's accounts, by most polls, the remain choice, the remain option would prevail. So that would be the best scenario. And that scenario became a little bit more likely today. At the same time, what became a little more likely today was a general election, in that there's a lot of anger among very conservative Tories, pro-Brexit types, against May, and so there could be another move against her. I think probably she'll stay in office. I think it's more logical that there would be a second referendum. There's also a possibility that's been talked about of Parliament breaking into what would be a kind of committee of the whole and taking, in a sense, straw votes on what kinds of options, what kinds of provisions might win a majority. And those so-called indicative votes could give some guidance to whoever is in government, presumably May, as to trying to negotiate a revised deal. I don't know whether the party leaders would actually allow that degree of flexibility to members of parliament, but that's a second option, which to many people seems the most logical thing to do, see what people would in fact support and then go get it. But a second referendum also, as I said, became a step closer, a bit more likely today. And I certainly would support that. And one of the funny things, which you've probably heard people talk about, is that since 2016, when the vote occurred, a fair number of people who are older have passed away, and there's many, many new voters who've been added to the rolls. And if you assume nobody changed their opinion, but you simply took, you know, subtracted the the people who are no longer with us and substituted for them the people who've just joined the rolls, that all by itself, that would produce a completely different outcome that would strongly, strongly favor Remain. So, that'd be my scenario.
we're left with that, and I thank you very much for joining us, James Cronin.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with James Cronin, who's a professor of history at Boston College and an associate of the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, and he serves on the board of 20th Century British History and on the board of Contemporary British History. He's the author of The Politics of State Expansion, New Labour's Past, What's Left of the Left, and his latest book is Global Rules, America, Britain, and a Disordered World. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into a roadmap to fix our broken democracy, which the Democrats are not paying any attention to.
All across the town, all across the night, everybody's driving with four headlights. Black or white, you're turning on your face, a new religion. Everybody's sitting around watching television.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University, named a Guggenheim Fellow for Constitutional Studies. Her books include Bourgeois Radicals, Eyes Off the Prize, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She's a columnist for The Guardian, where her latest article is American Democracy is in Crisis. A House Bill Could Help It Heal. And her latest book, just out, is One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carol Anderson.
Thank you so much, Ian.
So, Carol, I'm astounded at how little attention H.R. 1 is getting, even from liberals and progressives, because if you look at it, it's incredibly radical in the sense it will heal so many of our problems. Now, everybody says, well, you know, it's dead on arrival in the Senate. But surely that's not the point. Surely the point is to let the American people know which party is on their side in terms of supporting, nurturing, and defending democracy, as opposed to which party wants less and less democracy, but only democracy for those who vote Republican.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, one of the, to me, it's not that, the point, as you say, is not that it's dead on arrival in the Senate. I mean, Mitch McConnell made that very clear when he called it a power grab. And he, you know, he was going to see to it that it wouldn't get onto the Senate floor for a vote. But this isn't about Mitch McConnell. This is about making clear that we've got a prescription, a recipe for undoing a lot of the damage that several Supreme Court decisions and the Republicans have done to American democracy, dealing with issues of campaign financing, to voter suppression, to transparency and ethics so that presidential candidates' tax returns, 10 years of them for review.
Well, in your article, Carol Anderson, at The Guardian, American Democracy is in Crisis, A House Bill Could Help It Heal, you mentioned there are three Supreme Court decisions which have undermined, if not crippled, our democracy. Could you briefly sketch those three?
Yes. One of the first ones was in 2004, and it was a decision dealing with extreme partisan gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. And extreme partisan gerrymandering is when the Republicans, it's like when any party, but this time it was the Republicans, drew the maps for districting that created such an imbalance that it put more representatives in areas, in the rural areas that aren't as densely populated, and fewer representatives in the major urban areas. And so you got, instead of like 11 Republicans to 8 Democrats, you got a 13-6 balance. Extreme partisan gerrymandering has, the Supreme Court said, we can't even tell if it's extreme partisan gerrymandering. There's nothing we can do. And that has allowed the states to know that they're not going to get Supreme Court review, and they've gone hog wild with it in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, et cetera. So, and it has put 16 to 26 additional Republicans in the U.S. Congress, which has helped, which helped provide the cushion for instance, that god-awful tax bill that went through, and helped to try to scuttle the Affordable Care Act, and to make difficult getting reasonable gun regulations through. The next bill is Citizens United. Decision is Citizens United. That Supreme Court decision in 2010 basically said that corporations had First Amendment rights, and it took the restrictions off of major donations to candidates, and allowed a level of secrecy about donors to come into play. Obama had warned that it could allow foreign entities to begin funding American elections, and turns out that's exactly what happened. So we've got $1.4 billion in funding through dark money in this last campaign, and we don't know who funded it. Then the final one was a decision, Shelby County v. Holder in 2013, that I believe will have the same kind of horrific legacy as Plessy v. Ferguson. Shelby County v. Holder gutted the Voting Rights Act, and it allowed voter suppression to metastasize across the United States. Tactics like voter ID laws that are racially discriminatory, voter roll purges, closing polling stations in minority neighborhoods, all of these things designed to make it much harder for minorities to vote in the United States.
And I was going to add there, Carol, when you mentioned that Barack Obama was prescient in warning us about dark money, saying that our elections could be bankrolled by America's most powerful interest, or worse, by foreign entities. When he said that, in the audience, Justice Alito mouthed, "Not true." What is it about the Supreme Court justices who more and more appear to be partisan? And the main decision, of course, was written in Citizens United by Kennedy. He somehow thought that it would be self-correcting, but it wasn't. In other words, there'd be full disclosure. You just pointed out how much dark money's been flowing in, $1.4 billion in this last election. There was, shortly after the Citizens United decision, an attempt to pass the Disclose Act, which would have done what Kennedy claimed the bill, the ruling did, which it didn't. And that, of course, was voted down by the Republicans. Overturning a constitutional amendment to get rid of it would take forever. Is there a strategy, do you think? I don't know. HR1, I think, leapfrogs over everything. But let's focus on that then. Does HR1 literally solve all of our problems? That's the impression I got.
You know, HR1 will begin to help, but the damage is deep, and we've got to recognize that. One of the things that I mentioned in the article is that you've got close to 50% of Americans who don't believe in democracy. That is absolutely telling, and a lot of it has to do with the ways that the system really appears very rigged and absolutely resistant to change. And HR1 goes after that. And so in terms of dark money, we had campaign finance law before, where you had to disclose, where you had limits. We can do that again. And we need a court. Right now, you know, we've got a court that doesn't believe, for instance, that race is a factor, doesn't believe that money is a factor, doesn't believe in a lot of things. And these, as I've noted, these decisions have been extremely harmful to American democracy. In the 2016 election, I mean, one of the things people talked about was what was going to happen to the Supreme Court if Trump came to power. And we see.
And again, I'm speaking with Carol Anderson, who's a Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University, named a Guggenheim Fellow for Constitutional Studies. Her books include Bourgeois Radicals, Eyes Off the Prize, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She's a columnist for The Guardian, where her latest article is American Democracy is in Crisis, A House Bill Could Help It Heal. And her latest book is One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Well, it looks like, though, the Republicans are more concerned and more motivated about the court than Democrats are, which I find extraordinary because the results have been so alarming. And, of course, we saw one of the most naked power grabs, to use Mitch McConnell's term, when he denied Merrick Garland even a hearing on Obama's nomination.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And we saw the other part of that power grab when Chuck Grassley rushed through Kavanaugh's confirmation, and with only 7% of his documents available, with putting in basically embargoes on the documents that could not be revealed to anybody. I mean, we saw a shredding of the rules and a shredding of the process, of the vetting process for a lifetime appointment on the highest court in the land. So Mitch McConnell and the Republicans know power grabs. And I think part of the problem is that Democrats believe that they are dealing with another political party, that the Republicans are just another political party. But the Republicans have moved so far to the right. And as Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann in their book, and I hate it when I blank like that.
No, I'll cue you. It's even worse than you think.
That's it. It's even worse. Thank you. They've made it. They have really documented beautifully that the Republicans have moved from being a governing party to an insurgency, an obstructionist party, and the Democrats haven't caught up to that yet, to understand exactly what they're dealing with.
But can they be shamed? In other words, can you make the case to the American people that for all of our talk about being the world's most enduring democracy and our pride, which we exhibit on the 4th of July in this country and its constitution, can we basically say, look, we have a party that doesn't believe in democracy anymore. They only believe in power, and that they don't want to win fair and square. You know, rather than deal with the demographic challenges, which they fear, that the increasingly white party fears the increasingly diversified Democratic Party, and demographics indicate that whites will be a minority in this country in one or two decades. Rather than come up with a better message, they've decided to basically suppress the vote and use the Supreme Court through Citizens United and other decisions that you outlined, Carol Anderson, to simply, you know, deny as many votes that would vote against them and make sure every last one of their people come out to vote. I don't think it's a sustaining strategy over the long term, but one of the things that's scary about it is that when you talked about the decision that affected Pennsylvania, where the rural vote was increased and the urban vote was decreased, that is exactly what the Electoral College does. And a lot of, and in fact, you mentioned Ornstein. I've spoken to Norm fairly recently, and he's concerned that by the year 2040 or 2050, we will have 70 Republican senators from rural red states to 30 Democratic senators from urban blue states simply because of the Electoral College.
And I mean, there's so much going on in here. And so you ask, can they be shamed?
Right.
And the 2018 midterm, I think, was a key part of that answer, where you had 40 seats slipped in the U.S. House of Representatives to the Democrats because you had massive voter turnout on the part of Democrats. Now, understand that that massive voter turnout was in spite of voter suppression. You had civil society in there doing what I call the heavy lifting of democracy, getting people their IDs like Vote Riders does, getting people their IDs so that they could vote, setting up private car systems so that people could get to their polling stations now that over 800 polling stations have been closed in the states that had previously been under the purview of the Voting Rights Act. You had lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, like I'm here in Georgia, blocking and getting injunctions against so many of the different things that these voter suppressors were trying to do, from throwing out absentee ballots because there wasn't a signature match, to suspending people's voter registration because a hyphen wasn't in the database but was on the voter registration card, those sorts of things. That massive voter turnout was a sign that the Democratic constituency understands the insurgency that the Republicans are doing to undermine democracy. Now, I've got to say, part of what, you know, you talked about the change in demographics, and I talked about how the party has moved further and further right ever since the Southern strategy that wooed in the Southern Democrats. But what becomes really fascinating in this is that what they would have you believe is that minorities have it easy here in America, that minorities are just given things. You know, you show up to college and you get in.
Right.
I'm laughing, but not really.
Right. Well, you remember Mitt Romney characterized it as the makers versus the takers. And that's the way the Republicans see it, that everybody else is a freeloader except these hardworking.
Everybody else is a freeloader.
Right.
So then why the fear of becoming a minority? Because they know that that narrative is a lie. And it was going to require doing some heavy thinking and some heavy self-reevaluation on the part of the Republicans. But Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth said down in Birmingham during the Civil Rights Movement, you know, a rattlesnake doesn't commit suicide. You just can't shame them. You can't shame them.
Right.
And that's where we are right now. They are beyond shame. I mean, we have had pedophiles in their parties, and they just shrugged. We have had evidence of Russian interference. They shrug. We have had evidence of all kinds of graft and corruption and malfeasance. They shrug. There is no shame. They have to be voted out. And so the kind of silence that there has been on H.R. 1, I find striking, but I also think that it's part of we get geared up for an election and then we kind of go after the election. But what we must do is to stay in election mode and understand that this work of recovering this democracy is going to require that we not let down, but that we are ever vigilant, that we are putting pressure and accountability measures on our representatives to push for reforms, major reforms, restructuring in the way that we vote and the ways that politicians are held accountable for what they do in the elections and after the elections.
Well, just in closing, it would seem, though, that H.R. 1 does much of what you're talking about. It's not getting the publicity. Obviously, the Republicans don't want to know about it, but that's not the point. The Democrats should be screaming from the rooftops that they've got the answers. This is a simple, clean way, and you could argue it's nonpartisan. It's about American democracy. Of course, the Republicans are trying to say it's a partisan move, which it's not. What's going on our side? I mean, the Democrats got overshadowed in launching H.R. 1 by the Green New Deal, which is very aspirational compared to HR1, which is extremely doable and practical. And two, you've got, you know, some of the statements by the new members of the House have been overblown by the other side. They've been effectively a gift to the Republicans to distract and divide. So, I mean, why do we get distracted and divided by these cynical people? The ball's in the court of the Democratic Party and people in this country who vote Democrat. So, you know, let's get on with it. What's wrong?
Yeah, I agree. Let's get on with it. I almost feel like Marvin Gaye. Let's get it on. Because, and again, I think that part of it is this false feeling that the Republicans are still a party in the kind of traditional sense. And so still doing the tit-for-tat party thing, when in fact this is a very different animal. And we have to recognize that it, you know, it's like when with what they're doing with the nominations and confirmations of judicial appointments to the federal bench, they've just torn up the entire process where blue slips that where a senator could say, nah, I really don't like this one, would stop that nomination cold. Well, now the Republicans have said, nah, we don't care about blue slips, and we're going to put somebody through, and because we have the majority in the Senate, we're going to confirm them. And that tainting of the vetting process and that flooding of the federal judiciary with basically right-wing ideologues is the Republican strategy to deal with when the wave of voters votes them out of power. They will have a right-wing bulwark in the judiciary to overturn progressive legislation. We have to understand that and mobilize for it.
I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Carol Anderson, who's a Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University, named a Guggenheim Fellow for Constitutional Studies. Her books include Bourgeois Radicals, Eyes Off the Prize, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She's a columnist for The Guardian, where her latest article is American Democracy is in Crisis, A House Bill Could Help It Heal. And her latest book is One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy.
Freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Bogota, Colombia, is Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College, who serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly, and has also been a consultant to the United Nations, the Center for Global Development, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's the author of U.S.-Venezuela Relations Since the 1990s and Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, now out in a second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Javier Corrales.
Thank you for having me.
And you're right next door to a country that's literally falling apart. Do you think that the current U.S. strategy, which appears to be an attempt to weaponize aid, along with Maduro blaming the U.S. for the power outages, my sense is that this could spin out of control into a kind of, you had two rival demonstrations just a couple of days ago, the pro-Maduro and the anti-Maduro people. Obviously, the latter are in growing majority. Even people within his his areas, the Chavistas, are also starting to turn against Maduro. But what's your sense, since you're there right next door and you're from Venezuela? It's a tragic situation. Obviously, we should all be in solidarity with the people in that country who are suffering. But their politics are very polarized and divided. So is the U.S. going to, policies going to bring about a solution, or are they going to worsen it and perhaps spark a civil war?
Let me begin by saying that the economic devastation that we are seeing in Venezuela now for the past 5 years, but made increasingly worse as a result of this blackout, is something that we have never seen in the Americas. This is the kind of situation that we see in countries ravaged by very serious civil wars. And there's no war in Venezuela, and yet the fact that there is no power and no food is and no medicine and no ways of generating income is really very bizarre for people who have been studying Latin America. Yes, this is a country of financial crisis, but this is just a war economy, meaning no economy. That's number one. Number two, I think the problem that we're seeing is that the Maduro regime has been able to withstand what is now one of the most sophisticated form of political resistance that we have seen. The support for Maduro is very low. The polls, the most recent polls, suggest that he has 20% of support, if that much. And Guaido and the opposition have overwhelming support. Plus, they have a lot of international support, not just support from the United States. And yet, to try to pressure a political change has been impossible. And so the question is, you know, what explains the durability of this regime? I don't think there is any political analyst who would say this is a regime that is surviving because it is still popular. I don't think that's what it is. There are other explanations, but there is no doubt that it has proven very difficult to dislodge, and there's very little awareness of what comes next at this point. The United States, the strategy of the United States is to apply economic pressure on the government, but it doesn't seem like that will ever be enough to bring the government down for now. We're in a bit of a stalemate at the moment. An analogy that I like to use is that it's a little bit like the Maginot Line during World War One, when two sides were basically not moving, the Germans on one side and the French on the other side, and they were capable of resisting each other but not making major advances, and that's where we are now in Venezuela.
Well, the U.S. has decided to pull its diplomats out. There was concern that when the diplomatic relations were broken off between the two countries that the U.S. kept its delegation there, and some people thought they were sort of bait to be held hostage. What do you make of that latest move?
Well, you know, there one could make the case that living in Venezuela is now living in hell, and so there is a humanitarian reason for asking the U.S. personnel to leave. It could also be that the worst is yet to come, that the United States may have other plans, that they know things are going to get worse. So I don't know. It could be interpreted in many different ways. Yes, there is a humanitarian and security reason to make the decision that U.S. personnel, for their safety and their health, should leave. But it could also be that maybe the United States is imagining a bigger military showdown. I don't know. It's all speculative, and I have no information.
So, I get a lot of complaints from listeners suggesting that that in criticizing Maduro that you're somehow, you know, turning a blind eye to American imperialism and the history of American imperialism. And, you know, when you've got people like Bolton and Elliot Abrahams and Senator Marco Rubio running U.S. policy, it does give you pause that the hawks are in charge, but surely is capable of keeping two thoughts in your head at the same time. One is that Maduro is a disaster, and that the Trump administration are a bunch of hawks, and Trump keeps talking about keeping a military option on the table, which seems reckless and dangerous. So is there any way that you can cut through this, Javier, and you know, come up with something that's going to get the American left to support and recognize that this is really about how best to stop the agony and misery that the Venezuelan people are enduring? Or is it just so polarized on both sides that you have polarized attitudes in the broader external world as well as what's going on in Venezuela?
I mean, I am incredibly sympathetic to all the reservations about the Trump administration. I think on a number of fronts, domestically and internationally, the Trump administration is duplicitous. It's dangerous. It's very a force for disruption rather than a constructive force. But I would say that here in Venezuela, we're facing a situation where to try to defend Maduro in order to make a point about U.S. imperialism actually does enormous damage to the cause of fighting imperialism. We want to make sure that we never make the mistake of, in order to be able to criticize the Trump administration for all its problems, that we end up supporting what has got to be the government in the Americas that has most seriously violated the most important values of progressive forces in the world, all of them. You know, we have here a petrostate that became a military state that then morphed into a narco state that is now a failed state and that is a very repressive state. There has to be a way for people who are anti-imperialist to be able to say we can be against the Trump administration for a number of things, but not necessarily take the side of the Maduro administration. That's how I see it. This is really a country, Venezuela is a country that has been taken over by mafias, and it requires an international approach. And we want to make sure that the United States is able to act in a way that receives information and advice from international actors, but not to enter in a situation where we're like, well, you know, the Trump administration, if it's going to be involved, then I'm just going to take the other side. That doesn't seem to be a sophisticated position, for me at least.
Well, there have been reports that I've heard from the BBC in Venezuela where they interview people in the streets, and including people in, you know, in the Bolivarian circles, the supporters of the Chavistas, I guess they're called. They're just as fed up with this government as anybody else, by the sound of it. And one of the things that one of the people in the street said in response to questions about the electricity blackout and Maduro blaming it on the Americans, and they said, well, he always does that, you know. But the real reason is, apart from the fact that there was apparently a bush fire that shut down the main grid from the big dam, the person in the street in Caracas said, look, all of our talented people have left the country. We have no engineers left. That's why we can't pump any oil, and that's why our electricity's, we've had blackouts. Is there something to that?
Yes. Yes, there is a brain drain, but there has also been, prior to the brain drain, there was a money drain. During the good years of Chavismo, the funds that were devoted to infrastructure were basically embezzled or stolen or diverted to other sources. So there is the combination of a brain drain, absolutely, but this is also the result of a sort of capital flight driven by corruption that occurred during the good times. And so everything is vulnerable in Venezuela because there was a significant decapitalization of the country as a result of the massive forms of corruption that existed during the good times. So that's a good explanation. You have this decapitalization occurring with this brain drain and consequently facing this electrical problem, massive problem. There's no way to solve it quickly. And that is why the blackouts have lasted for as long as they have and why they're going to continue to last.
Well, one wonders, though, at what point, you know, the only am I correct in suggesting that the only people that are sort of organized, if that's the right way to put it, are the military and the criminals? I've talked to people for the longest time in Venezuela it's got one of the highest crime rates in the world, I think, comparable to Honduras. And that situation is getting worse. There have been reports of looting. So is that the next shoe to drop, that there'll be, you know, criminal gangs roaming around? And what is the Maduro government seems to be pretty ambivalent. First of all, they never really dealt with the crime issue. And then they've got their own vigilantes as well running around. So is anybody going to take on that issue, or is it just going to deteriorate?
I agree completely with this assessment. I agree with the assessment that there are two types of criminal activities happening. One is uncoordinated criminal activities carried out by street gangs, which the government has been unable to contain or unwilling to contain. And then there is the criminal activity that is happening as a result of the government contracting out vigilantes and paramilitaries. So you have these two forms of military and activities happening. We don't know how much longer other elements of the military are going to continue to tolerate this disarray. This political scientists call this oligopoly of violence rather than a monopoly of violence, which is what we used to think states always wanted. So there are people who are saying that at some point, some forces in the military are going to be like, we have to bring some order into this disorganization of violence and criminal activity in Venezuela. But for now, there seems to be a certain degree of tolerance for street gangs and random criminality, and also tolerance for states contracting out violence to paramilitary and vigilante groups.
Well, at this point, just in the last couple of minutes, Javier Corrales, what do you think is going to be happening politically here in terms of, Juan Guaido has been sticking his neck out, obviously. He didn't get arrested when he returned from the Lima talks. And then they've apparently, the government, Maduro, is investigating Guaido for sabotage of the electrical system, and there have also been prominent journalists arrested. So obviously Maduro doesn't quite know what to do with Guaido, doesn't he? He certainly hasn't arrested him yet, presumably because there'd be a backlash. So what do you expect to happen in terms of this peculiar situation where you've got two heads of states butting heads?
Yeah. Well, look, I don't know what's going to happen. Anything can happen here. You have two groups, each powerful enough to fight, but also to resist. So what I can say is this. During most of the Chavista years, running from 1999 to about 2017, it was the opposition that was resisting, trying to survive, being targeted, being attacked. Now what we're seeing is that it is the government that is trying to resist. There's no question that the opposition has the upper hand now. It has international support. And what we're seeing is the government resisting. Can it resist? Yes, it can. It won't be able to govern, but it could resist. Does it mean that it could also crumble at some point, collapse, fall apart? Yes. But it also has the capacity to resist. So we're now seeing a period in which the upper hand is with the opposition and the international coalition supporting it, but the government has gone into some kind of bunker mentality, hoping to resist during the duration of the storm. And I think it could very well manage to survive it. It's the worst assault the government has ever faced, but I don't think that its capacity to resist has completely disappeared just yet.
So just in closing, but time doesn't seem to be on their side, not that time necessarily is on the side of the opposition. What do you, at what point does it snap?
At what point does the opposition snap or the government?
Well, either side. I mean, at what point is there resolution or is it just agony going to continue? I mean, you got hyperinflation, right. You got no electricity, people are starving, they have no medicine. The human beings simply can't put up with this indefinitely, surely.
Right. Look, I think that the opposition is at risk of losing the energy as a result of these economic conditions that you're describing. But I think the government faces the risk of the defections that are taking place becoming out of control. This is a country that is not producing, it's not doing anything, it's not even producing oil. And it could very well be that the levels of defections that we're seeing get to a point where they're going to be like, you know, we can do this better than Maduro. Some of us could actually do this better. You know, not necessarily a transition to democracy, not necessarily a transition to a Guaido-based government, but certainly Chavistas from within determining that one of us could do this much better than the current team. And so this would be a succession. That's a possible scenario, absolutely. But, you know, once there is a succession in place, it's very difficult to predict what comes next. So all scenarios are possible at this point. There is a stalemate. Both groups, both sides, as I said, are demonstrating a remarkable capacity to survive and resist in the worst possible circumstances. I wish I knew what will it take for either side to snap. I just don't know.
Well, Javier Corrales, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Javier Corrales, who is in Bogota, Colombia. He's a professor of political science at Amherst College. He serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly. He's been a consultant to the United Nations, the Center for Global Development, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and is the author of U.S.-Venezuela Relations Since the 1990s and Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, now out in a second edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.